Well, if you have a Bible, please do keep it open at that passage which Helen just read for us from Ecclesiastes chapter 9. 4 months ago, on New Year's Day, there were young couples across the country looking forward to the best day of their lives, the perfect May wedding. There were others who had booked their dream holiday for this summer, the one they had been saving for years. And there was that sense of real excitement for the new year. There were also small business owners enjoying a slow but steady growth and looking forward to the likelihood of a real breakthrough in 2020. So much of what makes our lives today bearable is the anticipation of what we have planned for the future. I wonder what it is for you. What are you looking forward to that gets you out of bed raring to go each morning? But of course, the engaged couple and the person who'd booked their flights to Australia and the small business owner, they've all had their plans wrecked over these last couple of months. So in a world that's like this, what can we be certain of? And how can we enjoy life when all our plans can be in danger of being wrecked? Teacher in the book of Ecclesiastes has been circling around these sorts of questions throughout his book. And now he wants to challenge us face on. He's got two big lessons that penetrate our thoughts and our desires this morning. Here's the first one. There's only one thing you really know about the future. Verse 1. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. Everything that happens to us is in God's hands, but it's not in our hands. No one knows whether love or hate awaits them. Our love or hate here has a sense of good things and bad things. Maybe after COVID-19 is done, maybe 2021 will turn out to be a memorable year for you. But maybe 2022 will be terribly tough. For the next person, it might happen the other way around. We know that life is like that, don't we? As we look at what we've already experienced in life. So, for example, I could look back to the noughties, which was perhaps the best decade of my life. I could look back to 2002 when I first met Helen. I could look back to 2007 when we got married. I could look back to 2009 when we discovered that Helen was pregnant. But even in that generally really good decade, I could look back to 2000 when I was dealing with relationship turmoils. I could look back to 2003 when I was really struggling as a newly qualified teacher. I could look back to 2009 when I lost my grandmother. Most of those things I couldn't have predicted. I didn't know when they would happen. They were not in my control. Some were causes of joy and some were causes of sadness. We don't know which will come when, but as the ESV translates the end of verse 1, both are before him. Both will come, both good and bad things, at one point or another. Everyone will have a mixed experience. And verse 2, every one of us shares a common destiny. Maybe at our funeral, people will have so much to say about how kind and how selfless and how loving we were. Or maybe they'll be struggling to find anything to say other than he really loved his golf. But either way, no matter who we are all our lives will end with a funeral. Leading a godly life cannot get us out of the reality of death. Your death is the one thing in life you can be absolutely sure will happen, unless Jesus comes back first. Verse 3 says that this common destiny is an evil. That is, it is terrible. Death is not just passing into the next room. It is not just, oh, I'm looking down with a smile on you. It is an outrage. It is an unwanted intruder into God, the beautiful world that God originally created. And so the teacher says, our hearts are full of evil and there is madness in our hearts. As the 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes put it, life is nasty, brutish and short. Verse 4, he again puts it starkly. Sometimes children might ask each other, well, if you could choose to be any animal, which animal would you choose? Would you want to be a magnificent eagle? Or would you choose to be a lightning fast cheetah? But if you asked an Israelite, would you rather be a lion or a dog? They would think you were taking the mick, even asking the question. And not only are lions amazing, but dogs at that time were despised. Don't picture the cute little puppy, but rather the wild hound. But the teacher says, even a live dog is better than a dead lion. Although he mentions the word hope in verse 4, his point in verses 5 and 6 is that when we're dead, all the things that we once knew are completely forgotten. And all the things that our lives were about, all our emotions, whether good or bad, all of that too is forgotten. There is one thing that you can know about your future, and it is that you will die. And verses 11 and 12 take that one step further. They show us there is only one thing in the future that you can know for sure. Another thing that the teacher sees under the sun, that is in our broken Genesis 3 world. Apart from death, there is nothing else that we can predict in this life. Most of the time, the fastest runner will win the race. But if you can remember back to the 1992 Olympics, you may recall the 400 metres runner Derek Redmond, who was one of the favourites to win. And yet suddenly, in the middle of the semi-final, he tore a hamstring and his dreams were over and all the years of training came to nothing. Most of the time, the stronger army will win the battle. But maybe the weather conditions will suddenly change, or a stray bullet will suddenly kill one side's commander-in-chief and the tide will unexpectedly turn. Most of the time, the wise person will have food on the table to eat. But maybe, like in Zimbabwe in recent years, the farm will be forcibly seized by a corrupt government. National inflation will go through the roof and he will lose all of it. Most of the time, the brilliant person, the intelligent person will get rich. But maybe the stock markets will suddenly collapse. And maybe all their wisely planned shares will all become worthless. Most of the time, the learned person will gain favour. But maybe they will be falsely accused of something they didn't do and their reputation will be ruined. The only thing we can say is what the teacher says. Time and chance happen to them all. None of these things can be certain. So therefore, don't pin your hopes on those things that you hope lie ahead, but they're uncertain. There is only one thing you can know for sure about the future. Verse 12 pictures a fish happily going about its business, blissfully unaware that a fisherman is about to snap it up on his hook. He didn't see it coming. It came completely out of the blue. And likewise, we could easily find ourselves suddenly entrapped in a snare that we could never have predicted. There is one thing, only one thing, that we can be sure will happen in our lives here in our fallen world. All of us will die. Now, at that point, we might find ourselves asking, well, okay, that's fine, but doesn't Jesus' resurrection change things? And the answer is yes. The preacher, his understanding was somewhat limited compared with the full revelation we have in the New Testament. Yes, there are now two things we can be certain of about the future. Yes, we will die, but also Christ will return and those who trust in him will rise. Yes, Philippians chapter 1, it is better to die and be with Christ. But the answer to the question is also no. In this fallen world under the sun, we don't know anything except that unless Jesus comes back first, it will end in death. So why has the teacher been driving home this point again and again in Ecclesiastes? I think he needs to do that because it is so alien to the way we normally think and feel. If we hear there's been a plane crash, or if we hear there's been a motorway pile up, or if we hear of someone else getting dementia, we just don't really think it'll happen to us. We think that we have enough control over our lives, that things will roughly go the way that we've planned. We think that we'll get good grades. We think that we will get married one day. We think that we'll have a successful career. We think that we'll have a happy retirement. Maybe COVID-19 has taught us to stop a moment and think. And the teacher is drumming the lesson again and again into our slow brains so that we cannot miss the point. There is one thing, and only one thing, that you can know for the future, about the future for certain. And therefore, don't pin your hope on those other things that may never happen. That marriage, or that holiday, or the success at work. If you look to those things for comfort and for hope, at one point or another, they will let you down. There is one thing, and only one thing, you could know for certain about the future. But then secondly, there are so many things that God has given you to enjoy now. Look how verse 7 starts. Go. Don't hang around worrying about tomorrow. Go. Don't hang around speculating on all the things in your future that you simply don't know. Go, get out there and enjoy the things that God has given you today. Enjoy the food that God has given you. Enjoy the wine that he gives you. Enjoy them with gladness and with joyful hearts. God doesn't want us to look down on those simple pleasures. They're not something unspiritual. God has approved these things, the teacher says. They are gifts from him. It's the same thing that we've been seeing throughout the book. It's all about gift and not about gain. Not about us toiling away to try and get gain for ourselves, but rather receiving and enjoying the good gifts that God gives to us. You might wonder as you look at verse 8 what's going on in that verse. Always be clothed in white, and always anoint your head with oil. in that culture, white clothes and oil on the head were clothes for a joyful celebration. So he's saying to us, don't live in mourning. Don't grieve because these things are only temporary. Buy yourself a new dress. Wear a colourful shirt. And definitely don't wear a black tie. Verse 9, if you're married, enjoy life with your husband or wife. Not just put up with them. Now, of course, marriage is hard. All marriages are hard work. And for some, it is very hard. But as far as you can, enjoy life with your spouse. Don't let work or even church activities so take over your life that you have no time left to enjoy being with your family. And then verse 10 broadens the scope. Whatever your hand finds to do, put your mind and your heart into it. It may not be something that lasts, but it is still something God has given you today. So do it with all of your might. So how does all this link with what we've been seeing? That death is the only thing we can be sure will happen. I think there's a couple of connections here between those things. For one thing, if we don't know what is going to happen tomorrow, then we ought to embrace the good things that God has given us today. But also, if we live for food and for drink or for marriage as our source of ultimate lasting joy, well, those things will always let us down in the end. If your happiness depends on any of these things, then they will creak and they will collapse because you're putting them on them too much weight that they were never meant to bear. Death is like a bucket of cold water that is thrown on our face that wakes us up from our dreaming that these temporary gifts can bring us ultimate satisfaction. But if we accept that they are temporary, if we accept that they are limited, if we realise that there is something more important than those gifts, then they stop being unsatisfying idols. They become instead things that God has given us that we can enjoy today. There is so much more enjoyment in them when we receive them for what they are, rather than pinning out all our hope for the future on them. It's important to see that the things that the teacher mentions here are not an exhaustive list. Whatever your hand finds to do, enjoy that. So in this time of lockdown, enjoy the opportunities to connect with people on the phone or online. Enjoy pouring yourself a glass of wine at the end of the evening. Enjoy going for a walk or a run if you're able to do that. Enjoy God's beautiful creation, all the colours, all the views. Enjoy watching a film. Enjoy listening to music. Enjoy taking up a new hobby. Enjoy the blessing of serving and caring for other people. Enjoy writing a card to someone else to brighten up their day. Enjoy the opportunity to encourage each other over Zoom or on the phone. And thank God for all those good gifts that he's given you even now. And then when lockdown is over, enjoy seeing your friends and family again. Enjoy being able to meet up with Christian brothers and sisters again. Enjoy being able to go out and get a pizza. Enjoy being able to go to do the work that God has given you to do. Enjoy the opportunity that God gives you to serve him. And do those things with all your heart. Enjoy visiting the Lake District. Enjoy visiting a city that you've never been to before. Enjoy the trip to the beach, the paddling or the surfing or the sandcastle building. God is not anti-physical. It's not unspiritual to enjoy these things. Now, they're rubbish if we make them our ultimate thing. But they're really good if we enjoy them today as good gifts from God, who is the ultimate thing. In fact, if we don't enjoy these things, if we think it's somehow more godly to abstain from them, these gifts that God's given, well, what we're really doing is we're saying no thanks to our Heavenly Father. Let's take the example of the sandcastle building. David Gibson's book on Ecclesiastes, he uses it as a cover illustration. You can see it there, his sandcastle. When we're at the beach ourselves, we enjoy building sandcastles. Even more than that, in fact, we enjoy making ball runs where we construct this great thing, and then you could roll a ball all the way down it in a circle, a loop the loop. And when you're building something like this, you work at it, you work together at it. One of you might be gathering the stones, another one might be digging up the sand, another one might be building a moat. But if you're a younger child, when you go back the next day, there might be that sense of real disappointment, mightn't there? Perhaps mum and dad have to warn in advance that things are not going to be there when they arrive. They will have been washed away. The sandcastle does not last. Of course, for older children, they know full well that it isn't going to last. But does that mean it's not worth doing? Not at all. God gave it to us to enjoy today. Not to be a lasting thing, not to be an ultimate thing in the context of the holiday, not to be the thing that defines the holiday. He gives us good gifts, not so that we can put all our weight on those things, but to enjoy them as good gifts from God today. As verse 9 reminds us, all these good things are temporary. We enjoy them in the context of our lives that are a vapour. That doesn't mean they're meaningless, as the NIV puts it. That's a bad translation. God gives us these things to enjoy now, but they don't last forever. They are a vapour. They are a mist. And in fact, therefore, these things ought to make us long for something better. The preacher's regularly been taking us back to Genesis chapter 3, to this world that is broken. This world where we can't predict what lies ahead. This world where our work is often toilsome. This world that is like a mist and passes so quickly away. But here there are also hints of Genesis chapter 2. The unspoilt garden of Eden. Abundant good things to enjoy. Remember all the delicious fruits that God gave Adam to feast on. Life with your wife, Ecclesiastes speaks about. Well, remember Adam's joy when he first set eyes on Eve. God gives us food and drink and maybe marriage and all the other good things that he gives us. He gives them to us to enjoy now. But there's still a bit of a sense of, is that it? A phrase translated people in verse 3 and again in verse 12, literally the phrase is the sons of Adam. The sons of Adam. I wonder, is there a pointer there back to the book of Genesis? Life now is hard. The only thing we can be sure of is that we're going to die. And even the good things God gives us don't last. And that is because we are all sons and daughters of Adam, sharing in his sin, sharing in his guilt and in his broken world and in his death. But the New Testament tells us a second Adam has now come, the Lord Jesus Christ. A new Adam, a better Adam, an Adam who builds a new people and a new world that will not be spoiled by sin or death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, just as all those who were joined to Adam die, so all who are joined to Jesus will rise to resurrection life. Jesus died and rose to lift us out of the Adam world of death and to lift us into the Jesus world of life. As we taste the good things that God gives us now, we hunger for something more, like that lost world from Genesis chapter 2. As C.S. Lewis put it, if we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. And those better things, that other world, it is coming. Isaiah chapter 25 speaks about a fabulous banquet that is to come. Revelation 21 speaks about the perfect marriage, Jesus and his bride, his people. A perfect gladness and perfect joy. And it'll no longer be a passing mist. As the hymn says, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing his praise than when we first begun. In the last book of his Narnia series, C.S. Lewis describes the experience of entering into Narnia's equivalent of God's new world that's to come. And he says, the difference between the old Narnia and the new Narnia was like this. The new one was a deeper country. Every rock and flower and blade of grass looked as if it meant more. It was the unicorn who summed up what everyone was feeling. He stamped his hoof on the ground and neighed. And then he cried, "I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I have been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till now. The reason why we loved the old Narnia is that it sometimes looks a little bit like this. Come further up. Come further in." As David Gibson concludes in his book, those without Christ often abandon themselves to eating and drinking because sometimes it looks as if that's all there is to do before we die. But those who love Christ cherish eating and drinking because it looks like what we will do after we die. The gifts are from the real country. They smell and taste and feel like home.